So, tell me about your problems. Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of any MayNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Zach Birchie, and before we get into the call-out show, Justin's here.
Hey.
How's it going, man?
Pretty good. I've actually started having time to watch television, which hasn't happened in a while.
Hey, there you go. Anything good?
I've been revisiting a lot of things. Finally getting into the British show Downton Alley, which is amazing. I really recommend it.
Yeah, everyone keeps telling me to watch that. I believe I will.
Yes, it's on Netflix.
Oh, cool.
Although they encoded it with a bad stutter.
Ew.
So, like, most people will be fine with it. I'm just like, why does the motion stutter every second?
It runs on BBC America, doesn't it?
No, it's actually PBS.
Oh, PBS.
It's not a BBC show, it's ITV, so.
Well, I just assume.
Well, they have how many channels over there?
I'll see if they're rerunning it on PBS and maybe set my DVR or something. But yeah, no, I've heard nothing but good things.
Yeah, really, really good. Also reaching back at like a few other shows like Parks and Recreation, which I've been missing up until now. Also really good.
Finally coming around on that one, huh?
I know. I'm late to the party.
Took you a while.
also been catching up on some of the little stupid obsessive compulsive anime reauthoring projects that have been building up in my busyness.
Oh, any fun stories?
Well, I found the British version of Space Adventure Cobra, where they replaced all of the music with the 90s electro band Yellow.
Nice.
I really like it. They did a really shitty job on the Foley, so, like, you know, Cobra falls to the ground and it goes dunk.
Someone just, like, dropping a book on the floor or something.
If that. Well, more like someone just tapping it with their hand.
Ew.
It's I actually really like the music, and the dub is, I really like the dub, so had to redo that on Blu-ray.
Of course, had to, yes.
Well, you know, it's there. I can have a better presentation of it if I just work harder.
There you go.
What have you been watching?
TV-wise, just the usual stuff. I have to admit, like, I'm sort of scrambling to get everything done before midnight, because I'm really looking forward to Skyrim. This video game is coming out tonight. It's a giant time suck RPG that plans to destroy my weekend at the very least. But I'm excited about that. So it comes out at midnight tonight. I'm trying to get everything done before it eats my life alive.
As years go by, I find myself increasingly happy that I've never really gotten into video games that much.
Well, it's not common that this sort of thing happens. Generally, it's like once a year there's a game that totally consumes me for a couple of days, and then I'm done.
Okay.
It's not like all of my free time is spent playing video games or anything like that. But we're going to have a video game show coming up, I think, next week or the week after, because it's sort of a ridiculous time for that kind of thing. Literally releasing all of the major releases for the year in like a 2-week span, which is really annoying. But other than that, I watched I popped in the Dragon Ball Blu-ray, the new one.
The one that Funimation's been slaving over.
The one that we talked about on the show a couple of months ago. And boy, it looks great. Like, it looks pretty phenomenal. To the point where it's kind of like a benchmark for me, because I started thinking, not a lot of animation from the 80s and 90s television animation has been brought out on Blu-ray, almost none. This is a reference quality disc for that sort of thing. If we're going to see, you know, 80s and 90s TV animation on Blu-ray, it should look like this. Not everyone's going to put that amount of effort into it, but it can look really good. They did a great job. Like, I'm not a fan of the show or anything, and I literally, like, I skipped to episode 4 or whatever, and just hit play and like skip past the previously on Dragon Ball Z, you know, skip past that in the intro.
Right.
And it was a bunch of guys standing around staring at each other going, like that, and I started laughing, and I'm like, "No, I'm not watching you, Dragon Ball Z. Of course, I'm not going to watch you." But it looked phenomenal, so I mean,
that's good to hear. I always get worried about when a company just goes this far with remastering because the fans are so picky, and none of them really understand that the whole issue with analog video and analog photography is that there is inherently some play to it. Like there is no absolute right choice a lot of times.
Yeah.
That, you know, they're just, I worry that they're just going to pick it to death.
Well, I'm sure they will no matter what they do, but
right.
I know to my eyes, it looks as good as it's going to look. And it's like they preserved the grain just right. The colors are bright, but not too bright. Everything looks super sharp. It's a really, really nice job. And I'm kind of looking forward to, like, other 80s and 90s animation, like television animation, even cheap-looking animation like Dragon Ball being produced in this way. I hope more companies decide to do it. I hope Funimation starts to do more of it. But, you know, I doubt they can justify the expense on anything other than Dragon Ball for something like
this. I was
going to
say, what in the world would still sell that much?
Nothing. But, you know, I could see maybe in like some sort of pipe dream, Disney will decide to go back and put a bunch of crap out on Blu-ray from the 90s. Like, I'll get my DuckTales complete set or something on Blu-ray, and they'll have cleaned it all up, and it'll look nice and shiny.
Criterion edition of Goof Troop.
Oh, God.
I don't think anyone actually wants that.
No, I don't think they do. But there are select shows like Batman the Animated Series could totally use this. That's a classic. People love that. It's widely recognized as excellent television, no matter who you are. So that could totally see a release like this. But, you know, classics and, you know, genuinely recognized excellent shows, excellent animated shows from the 80s and 90s could use this treatment. I'd like to see more of it. Obviously, it won't happen very often, but...
No.
But anyway, so, yeah, pretty much that's it. I meant to get to Fairy Tail. They sent the first... set of that, and I never gave it a shot, and I always just looked at it and said, yeah, okay, I'm already watching One Piece. I don't need to see a ripoff of One Piece. And I don't understand how people gloss over the fact that that guy's art looks exactly like One Piece. Exactly.
It really does.
It looks exactly like it. Like, it's difficult to tell that it's not just other characters from One Piece. And people are just like, well, aside from the art, it's like, no, this guy literally took his whole style from that guy. Like, he just lifted his style 100%. I don't understand how people can even kind of overlook that. But,
well, you know, that brings up an interesting point, because we actually ran our second interview with that guy.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of question that everyone just wants to ask him, and no professional ever could.
No, you can't. It's rude.
Yeah, you would get shut down. You would never get an interview again.
You'd never talk to any of Kodansha's anything ever again. So yeah,
but it is really awkward to, you know, see that up and not address it, but there's really no way to address it.
No, aside from, I guess, ranting about it where you don't think they're listening.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I didn't wind up getting around to that. I've got the Loop Guru. I don't know how to pronounce it. The movie, came in. I haven't gotten to that yet. But maybe next week.
I saw the title of that and I'm like, that sounds like a skin disease.
It's a good point. I have no knowledge of the production of this thing. I don't even know what it's about, but it's sitting on my shelf, ready to go. So I'll get to it at some point. But yeah, other than that, it's been pretty slow.
Yeah, I've been working on several things, and Chris also assigned a reading to me. So I'm like reading four books at once while watching four shows at once. And I'm just, yeah.
You mentioned that you're actually revisiting Daria.
Yeah, that's one of the shows. I was putzing around on my boxy box, and there it was, streaming from MTV's website, and I gave it a shot. And I had friends that were really into it when I was a teenager, but I was a little too into the Japanese stuff. I wasn't ready for it.
Mm.
And honestly, it's aged really, really well.
Yeah, it's a good show.
I mean, visually, it looks like very mid-90s. In fact, I was even able to point out crappy Avid slowdown effect. But No, it's the wit is still there. Interesting how attitudes change on a number of things. Like, they were openly goofing on parents that wanted to watch their kids' sugar intake.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, in the 90s, that was kind of lame.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had a, you know, Daria and her friend watch a show called Sick Sad World, which is now just what all American reality TV is. Mm. It just, you know, here is a guy who will eat his own feces.
Yikes. Yeah, that's very, I mean, now that's like deep cable. That's all of deep cable.
Yeah, it's just like, that's, you know, that was counterculture in the 90s. Now it's just what we do.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, it's funny you mentioned that because I've been watching the new Beavis and Butthead.
Oh, yeah, I saw one episode of it.
It's really funny. I really was not expecting to laugh as hard as I did, but it's really funny. It's funny how and the show hasn't really changed, like, at all. Same characters, same exact characters. They didn't change the look of really of anything.
Dude, I noticed that, you know, the parts where it's just cutting to the two of them talking while watching television.
They're not even reanimated. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just old analog screen caps from the 90s.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's, I mean, obviously they're making it on the cheap. But the two characters are still, it's like evergreen portrayal of dumbass teenagers that hasn't changed. Like, that hasn't changed. You know, kids are still fucking dumb. And it's hilarious how dumb they are. And it's really funny. Like, if you ever liked the original show, absolutely watch the new one. Because I'm enjoying the hell out of it. They do occasional music videos. A lot of the stuff that they spoof, or a lot of the stuff they riff on is MTV reality shows. But the stuff that they're riffing on is really funny.
It's ripe for it.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, I mean, you'd think making fun of Jersey Shore is a fish in a barrel, but the jokes they're making are very, it's sharp. It's sharp stuff. I mean, Mike Judge is a smart guy, and he's made some good stuff. And obviously, he came back to this because it's the most successful thing he's ever made. And he's sharp as a tack. It's really, really funny stuff.
Yeah, I only saw the one episode, but the hand in marriage episode.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I really enjoyed it though. I don't love it, but I like it enough that I will definitely watch more.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. I was just surprised because I was like, wow, they're bringing that back. And I remember enjoying it when I was a teenager. Obviously, I didn't really get it. I had friends who would like think it was cool to imitate Beavis and Butthead. It's like they don't understand that you're supposed to be laughing at these idiots.
Oh, it's like kids that want to grow up to be like Cartman.
Yeah, oh, exactly. God, is that a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. Okay. But I was laughing so hard. It really took me back. I mean, it similarly, I started watching Adventure Time, which I would not recommend to you at all. You would not like that show, but
I've seen bits and pieces of it. And yeah,
it makes it. God, it makes me laugh. It just really makes me laugh. I think it's that really strange, pitch perfect surrealist humor that I love. That's really rare. Like, it's really hard to find. Like, I liken that show to like if the Conan writers had to make a kid's show that would get past Cartoon Network's standards. That's kind of how it's written. So those two are like the two things I think I'm enjoying the most right now. Weirdly, I never thought I would say that, but I guess Breaking Bad's not on anymore, so I can claim Beavis and Butthead and Adventure Time as my favorite things on TV.
You talk about going from high art to low art.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, let's go ahead and get to the rest of the show here.
Yeah.
Okay, first up, we're talking to Christian. Christian, what is on your mind, brother?
Hey, Zach. Well, I guess the appropriate term would be I'm a greenhorn anime critic is really what I am. I've only been in the game. I've been doing amateur reviews for really only about less than half a year right now, I'd say. But there's a lot of things to being a critic that I've discovered on my own that some things I suspected before I actually started and some things that I have realized right now, and I just wanted to sort of, you know, have a little discussion about, you know, what it is to really be a critic, especially with a niche medium like anime. So my first thing is, like, I think it's a safe assumption on my part to assume that most critics start out as fans. Is that safe for me to assume?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. You wouldn't... I think for most people, it's an interest that turns into a desire to do more than just consume.
Yeah, you want to contribute in a way, but some people may feel that they're not artistically inclined enough to be able to contribute in any creational sort of sense. So they decide, you know, they go a different route. And
well, it's a form of interacting with the product.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So I feel that. Despite most critics starting out as fans, fans of anything tend to feel a bit of a disconnect with most critics, especially the more well-known they are. I think maybe it has something to do with, I feel that fans may feel that critics are sort of put up onto this pedestal where they're sort of unreachable and where their arguments and their opinions can't necessarily reach them. Whereas, like, you know, someone like Roger Ebert would be very hard to get a hold of and get a response from.
Which isn't true. If you write him a nice letter, he will respond.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's very reachable. Roger Ebert is a man of the people, that's for sure.
I didn't know that. So then I feel that maybe, if that's true, then most people, I guess, don't feel like maybe they're just like me and they just assume that these people will be hard to get a hold of and that they can't defend these mediums that they feel a sense of that they have an affection for. All right.
Okay.
So, all right. So maybe I think what I want to move on to is, for people becoming critics, do you think there's one right way for a critic to act? Like, you know, should they be objectional or objective versus subjective? Should they try and not be confrontational if they have the capacity of being able to interact with viewers and fans?
Well, I'll say this. There's no such thing as an objective critic. If you're a critic who says, I'm objective, then you aren't providing an opinion, are you? Opinion is by its very nature subjective, and as a critic, you're supposed to be commenting on, analyzing a piece of art or a product or whatever. So saying, like, oh, you're not objective, it's a different way for people to say, I don't agree with your opinion. It's one of the many ways people try to turn a subjective argument that is at its core a disagreement on a matter of opinion into something where they can objectively prove you wrong. I see it all the time. I find it really annoying. It's at its definition, this is a subjective discussion that we are having about this work of art, and I took this away from it, and you took that away from it. There's no right and wrong here. I mean, people can have wrong opinions, that's for sure. You know, if someone's opinion is that Titanic is about battles in space, that's wrong. You know, so, and it can go down that road, but you are a subjective observer offering your opinion on something. So the notion that you're trying to be objective about things, other than going into something with a fair mindset about it. So you're not going into it thinking, I'm going to hate this or I'm going to love this. You know, the best critics, good critics, walk into things with an open mind, prepared for it to go either way, and analyze the product and the piece of art that it is, not what they thought it was going to be, not what they wanted it to be, but what it is. And so that's the height of objectivity that you can actually reach as a critic, I think, is going into it with a clear mind. Not thinking about whatever expectations you may have had or anything like that. It's just consuming and analyzing the product that's in front of you. And a lot of critics don't do that, frankly. They criticize based on what they thought something was going to be, not what it actually is. You see that a lot. But that's the only realm in which objectivity plays a role in criticism, I think. But in terms of, you know, you interacting with the fans and how to conduct yourself, I mean, there are people who are excessively confrontational, and that's a shtick. That's like a persona that they adopt. It's designed to make them popular. And you said you do video reviews.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, a lot of those video reviews are less that I've seen, and this is just a personal peccadillo with those. A lot of those video reviews, they're not really focused on the material or the review. It's a shtick to make the person in them some kind of internet superstar. That happens a lot. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an epidemic, actually. There are so many people who are like, I'm going to be the guy that yells about old video games. I'm going to be the person that rants about zombie stuff. You know, like, that. It's an attempt to make themselves a superstar on the internet, not actually criticize or analyze anything. Now, I assume your goal is, I'm not sure what your goal is. Is your goal to be a critic who is taken seriously as a critic, or do you want to be internet superstar?
Well, my main objective really is to critique animes that I don't pigeonhole myself to one specific genre. I'll review anything from, you know, I'll review ecchi to art house to yaoi to whatever I feel people may or may not like. I'm definitely trying to entertain, because these, my reviews are pretty lengthy, and I break up my review pretty much into three parts. I introduce whatever it is that I'm reviewing. I give a little bit of background to the product, to where it comes from, what it's about. Then the major chunk of my video is commentary, where I pretty much just I summarize what is happening within the first couple episodes, because I usually review the first four episodes, because that is usually the amount of time that I feel that people will give anything from like an anime or a TV show to grab their attention. And if it hasn't within that span of time, I feel that people shouldn't try and force themselves to go any further. So I do the first four episodes, and then at the end I do an assessment where I point out what it is I liked about the show, what it is I didn't, what things may work, what things don't, and then, you know, my viewers can take whatever they will from that. So I try to inform, but I try to also be entertaining at the same time.
Well, that's good. I mean, a good critic is also, you know, fun to read, fun to listen to. My favorite critics are people who speak in a unique and interesting voice, and you know, their words flow. Those are my favorite critics, and those are generally the most popular ones that have a strong voice and are entertaining about how they you know, bring their opinion across. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing bankrupt or invalid about that. You know, trying to be interesting is not a bad thing. You know, I've read there are critics out there who are very dry and very dull, and I don't read their stuff because their opinion isn't compelling. So, you know, trying to have a compelling opinion is important. So long as you are not changing your actual opinion of something in order to be more compelling. You know, critics always say, like, the hardest thing to write is a C+ or B- review where you didn't really like it and you didn't really hate it. That's why those are so hard to write, because it's very difficult to write compellingly about things like that.
Right.
So, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've got your head on straight in terms of your approach to this whole thing. But it sounds like maybe you're struggling a little bit with how to interact with your audience. I don't know.
Sort of, I guess. It's not so much my actual reviews have gotten a lot of controversy. Recently, however, I have gotten I guess from an outsider looking in, it wouldn't be like a firestorm, but for someone like me who is virtually unknown and has almost no audience, I've felt like I've been bombarded with all this this sort of controversy over the recent announcement that Shonen Jump is no longer going to be in a printed monthly anthology starting next year. And what happened is I saw a large amount of videos on YouTube of all these people just coming out on their cameras and just ranting and raving about how this is the start of the end of the manga industry, and that, you know, Viz and all the people who work there are lazy and greedy, and that, you know, if they're going to be pulling stunts like this, then why even attempt to support the industry when they can't support themselves and they do this kind of crap and all that. And
so people understand, so this is a bunch of reactionary idiots who have no idea what they're talking about. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I saw I saw enough of those videos to feel like, okay, somebody needs to speak from the other side of the fence on this. So I went out on, I got out my camera and I basically did pretty much what, you know, they did. I just sat down in front of the camera and just started debunking all of their opinions and pointing out, you know, all these fallacies of theirs and, you know, trying to show that their opinions are pretty, just pretty much impassioned bouts of crap is what I view them as. And people started coming after me saying things like, you know, dude, you are stupid. You don't know how people feel when they hold a crisp new Shonen Jump in their hands and things like that. And despite the fact that I explicitly stated at least 3 times in my video that I understand about wanting to have, you know, your physical medium in your hand, I get that. But, you know, still people that come after me saying, you know, I don't understand and that my opinion is stupid without actually offering up any sort of substantial arguments to the contrary.
This is all happening on YouTube, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's your problem. YouTube is awful. I don't know. I don't know if you've noticed this. It's a cesspool.
I know.
The commenters are terrible. Usually those videos where it's just some guy talking into his camera are usually awful. I'm sure even as someone who produces them, you can admit that they're normally pretty terrible. It's some idiot talking into his web camera and then people in the comments going, you're wrong. I mean, it sucks. I guess my advice would be stop doing that. Find another venue for your video reviews and for your commentary. There's got to be a better place because YouTube is terrible, man.
I also do on Blip TV. It's not as well known. And the thing about YouTube is, you know, despite the fact that it's pretty much just a breeding ground for, you know, idiots with a camera, it is the most widely viewed venue. And if you want to try and get, you know, any sort of following, whatever size it may be,
right,
YouTube is the most optional, you know, option you're going to have.
Yeah, no, I understand that. It just, the audience that you're going to get maybe isn't that great.
I've found that for some reason I just attract these Shonen Jump fanatics. You know, I go on their profiles and most, you know, the backgrounds are just like loaded up to the brim with like One Piece, Naruto, and all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't know why I haven't uploaded anything that has to do anything with Shonen Jump except for, you know, that.
Well, what you did is you antagonized them. Believe it or not, even though you were just trying to make a reasoned response, they see it as antagonism. This actually goes back to what you were talking about earlier, where fans feel like they have to defend their favorite shows from critics who maybe didn't like it.
Right.
To me, and in my head, and what the way I was taught about criticism and the way I was taught about film analysis and discussion of film is it's supposed to be a discussion. We're all supposed to be fans sitting in a room having a discussion, sometimes a debate, sometimes an argument about what the film meant or the film's artistic value or whatever. But it's all in good faith. It's all in good fun. It's for the love of film. And you might strongly disagree with somebody, but ultimately you're all fans. That isn't the way most people digest criticism and respond to film criticism. The way most people seem to respond to it is basically, fuck you, college boy. You don't like this because you don't get it. You don't like this because you're biased. You don't like this because whatever stupid-ass reason that isn't, you don't like this, and I do. Which is really the response that's what they're saying when they say all that stuff.
Right.
And so when you present that reasoned argument against all this ranting and raving about Shonen Jump, it's kind of the same thing. They respond to you not as, oh, well, I see your point, but I feel this way, or here's a rebuttal, or here's a counter-argument, and we're all fans, so let's not rip each other's heads off, and this isn't a life-or-death issue. You know, we're not arguing about, you know, whether or not to invade a country or something. We're sitting around talking about comic books. There's a lot of knee-jerk response out there. People internalize what they watch and what they read so that to the point where if you insult it, or if you say you don't like it, they take it as a personal insult, which is not I don't feel that's a healthy way to interact with media. You know, I love certain movies that people trash, and I don't take that personally. I didn't make the film. You know, I just really liked it. And so that's kind of what you're running into. It's an emotional response, not a reasoned one, or right. a critical one, or an analytical one. It's an emotional response. And a lot of critics, emotion is not really what they're trafficking in. They're trying to traffic in proper analysis and criticism, not emotional knee-jerk response to something followed by impassioned defense when you know someone quote-unquote attacks it.
Right.
So you're dealing with strong emotions, and you wandered into that and said, hey, you guys are being dumb about this, basically. And of course you're going to get that kind of response. And you might have been the only person doing that. And so now you're fueling their victimhood complexes, and now they have an enemy, and they'll attack you.
Right. I didn't try to make myself the bad guy. I did go in reasonably antagonistic, just because the things these people are saying, it admittedly is pretty stupid, but I did try to be reasonable. I didn't yell in my video. I got a little impassioned maybe once for about 3 seconds, and then I calmed down and I said, I don't want to be mad at you guys. You guys are the ones who, legitimately purchase manga, and that's why you guys are upset about, not having physical Shonen Jump anymore. You don't want to go online and read online manga. So I tried to show them that I wasn't trying to attack them. I was basically just trying to tell them, why don't we stop and calm down for a second? Because what you guys are saying is pretty much bullshit.
Well, here's the thing. If you want to become a critic or someone whose opinion gets read and respected and actually build an audience, you're going to have to realize that is the very nature of doing what it is you want to do on the internet, especially when it comes to stuff like anime and video games and like comic book movies. If that's the stuff you're talking about, you're dealing with an audience of super fans. And no matter what, if you say something controversial or you say something that goes against the popular fanboy opinion at the time, you're going to get yelled at, you're going to get called names, they're going to try to make you feel like shit. That is the nature of it, and you have to build up a thick skin. And so long as you're being honest with your opinion and you're passionate about your opinion, this is something you feel you need to express, it'll be worth it. Provided, you build an audience that appreciates your work. But you're always going to have people that fling their shit at you. That's just the internet.
Right.
There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, I get that. That's what, before I actually started doing this, that's what I really analyzed. I really actually tried to think about, what it is that makes a good critic. And when I stripped away all the layers and I boiled it down to its very core, I came up with what I think what makes a good critic is just, having an opinion that you can substantially defend. And as long as you can defend it, then nobody can really fault you for having that opinion. And so you need to stick with that opinion. You shouldn't be swayed by what other people say. You can, take other people's opinions into consideration and take their listen to their arguments and listen to what they have to say and acknowledge it, but you don't necessarily have to change your opinion just because of what, other people say. And I think that's what I've been trying to do, is really just, pick out what my opinion about something is and then just stick to my guns with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the nature of a discussion, I've had my opinion change after writing a review and reading the response to it. I mean, people, when somebody makes a good argument, I listen. That's why I refer to it as that we're all sort of in a classroom having a discussion about film together. It's possible to change my mind if you are being reasonable and have a good point and make your points really well. Criticism isn't necessarily just about sticking to your guns. It's about basically appreciating film in a very public and vocal way. I mean, best of luck to you, in your reviews. It's a rough world out there. You should consider, once you've got a big enough portfolio of video reviews and you're confident enough, try to submit to become one of the featured critics on any number of the sites out there that host video reviews. I would try to get out of the YouTube cesspool as fast as you can.
Well, I've actually been hired on by Anime TV as one of their web reviewers. So,
oh, good. Now, wait a minute. Do they actually pay?
I wouldn't believe so. I mean, I believe you guys had Erica Sherman, was it?
Yeah.
He was on before. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he said that anime TV brings in no revenue, so I wouldn't imagine that, you know, they pay anything. I mean,
okay, well, you said hired, so I thought, oh, is that a job? Okay, so you've been drafted to volunteer for anime TV, but that's really cool, and that'll get you a decent amount of exposure and put you in a more legitimate place than just some guy uploading stuff to YouTube. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so where can people find your work if they want to see it?
They can go on YouTube.com, look up Relikai Anime Reviews. That's Relikai. Or they can go on my blog that I've started up, which is relikaiproject.blogspot.com.
Okay, cool. All right, well, thanks for coming on and chatting with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
Okay, up next, returning champion, host of the Beta Male Experience podcast, it's Corey Proft, who we refer to around here as Profto. How's it going, Profto?
It's going good. It's going good, guys.
All right. So what's on your mind, man?
I just wanted to confer with you guys about the relative importance of a good ending for a TV show and a movie, I guess. You know, what makes a good ending, and, you know, what are some of our favorites and some of our horror stories about about endings. So,
I mean, I have to admit, I'm very permissive when it comes to weird or non-satisfying endings. I tend to be extremely forgiving. Like, I was fine with Eden of the East. I was fine with the TV Evangelion. I was okay with a lot of stuff people tend to hate. I mean, I loved the ending of Wolf's Rain, which a lot of people hated for some reason. But I don't know. Justin, what do you think?
I'm kind of in between. Like, there are some... I'm also forgiving of, like, out there and unexpected endings. Like, one of my favorite endings of all time is Nurse Angel Ririka, in which the show was actually canceled and they had to just kind of think of an ending real quick, at which point they kill off the... They decide to kill off the main 10-year-old girl that's the star of the show. And she spends the entire final two episodes tearfully saying goodbye to everything in her life as if she is dying of cancer.
Sounds like an ending you would definitely love.
And then at right literally the last 10 seconds of the show, they just completely pull the rug out from under you, and as the credits roll, you're left shouting at the TV. I loved it.
Nice.
I'm kind of with you guys. In my intense navel gazing about this subject, I came up with two things like that really make a good ending for me. And that's one: every good ending has to have a moment or scene or something that reflects that lets the viewer or me reflect on the main character's journey. From where they started and where they're headed off to. And that's why I think I'm actually with you about, like, Eden of the East. Like, you really got the sense of their relationship, Akira and the girls' relationship and how they evolved and where they were headed to, you know, by the time, like, the missiles were, like, dropping in out of the sky. I really liked it, too. I actually haven't seen the movie, so I can't really talk about those.
Well, that's the real ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean,
it was solid. Like, Bakano is the same way.
Yeah,
Bakano is pretty open ended, but you still kind of reflect and enjoy the. They give you a moment to enjoy, the flying pussyfoot ride that you just went on. Right. So, and then yeah, like plot doesn't become important. I don't think plot is very important in, like, those 13-episode episode TV series. But when they're longer, like Full Metal Alchemist, both of the seasons, like, if that didn't wrap up, like, well, I would have been, like, really fucking pissed. And they do, obviously. I think they do. So, I mean, I don't think wrapping up plot lines becomes... that important. It becomes more important as the longer the show runs. I mean, there's always there's exceptions to both of my rules, but in general sense, those are usually the two things that ultimately decide whether I think it's a good ending or not.
I can point to one thing I know that I don't like in an ending is when something is already a bit over the top and it just goes and goes and goes on and on and on forever. More over the top, more over the top, more over the top. And then the ending is just kind of like it just kind of stops.
Steam Boy.
Like Steam Boy. Or actually, the biggest disappointment for me was Helsing actually ends like that.
Gonzo.
It's just, well, no, not the TV show. The manga does this, which is why we're like the ultimate OVAs that are coming out. They're already past the good part of the manga. The manga descends into just chaos panels for like the entire last volume is just over the top psychedelic artwork of guys ripping each other apart. And it's just like, man, enough, like some character moments at the end of this, please. And that's, yeah, that I feel like that didn't wrap up very well. But just like if it's just too much or if they're trying too hard to wrap up every single plot thread, I guess I like an elegant ending, something that speaks to the core of what the show was about, doesn't necessarily give me absolutely everything, like, say, Harry Potter. we didn't need that epilogue. But yeah, I think maybe it's because of having watched so much anime and a lot of Japanese film, their style of ending, which is frequently ambiguous just as a cultural thing, that's that preference for that sort of subtlety and
ambiguity.
Maybe I like that now, because I used to kind of not like that. I used to get pissed off at the end of an anime.
Well, I think that a lot of the ambiguity comes from the fact that almost all anime protagonists are kids. Mm. At the high end, they're in college, but usually not even that. And I think that might be one of the reasons the Harry Potter ending didn't work for a lot of people, myself included, is because you can't put a period on someone's story when they're that young. It just doesn't work.
That's a good point.
I never thought of that, but yeah, that was a horrific epilogue. I guess, does a good ending or a bad ending, I should say, how does that ultimately affect how you recommend a show? Like, I find it to be like the deciding factor on whether one of my curious friends goes, hey, what should I watch? If it has a bad ending, I'll never recommend it, I find. Are you guys like that?
It kind of depends. It really depends, because it's different from series to series and film to film. It really depends on how bad the ending really is. If the ending is so bad, it kind of, in hindsight, ruins the show, like, I don't know, Lost.
I was going to say that.
You know, yeah, no, I'm not going to recommend that. But if the ending is like, well, the ending's a little bit of a letdown, but the journey's really great. Well, sure, but nothing comes to mind immediately where the ending sucked and the rest of it was pretty good, or good enough to recommend.
Yeah, usually if it derails around the halfway point or earlier.
Like, one that I can think of in the TV realm is The Sopranos, which is kind of unsatisfying, but that show is great.
I love that ending.
Yeah, I like that ending a lot.
I like the ending, too, but there's a lot of people that did not like that, so... I mean, and I think, like, Deadwood is also one of those where it kind of just doesn't have an ending because it was canceled.
Right.
But I wholly recommend that to everybody. I'm just like, you need to see this, even though it doesn't really end.
That's actually a saying that I've been saying for a while, is when something doesn't end, it stops. The story just doesn't come to a natural ending place. It's like the plane doesn't land, you just stop watching it fly. There's no more footage of the plane flying. And that can be good and bad. And there are good and bad examples of that. It's hard to think of one right off the top of my head, but I know I've said that about a lot of shows in the past. Or, look, this show just stops. It doesn't end. High School.
Well,
there are
a lot of shows that just, you know, the end destination isn't the point.
Right.
But if you do spend all this time building up to something and then that something never happens, yeah, obviously that's going to suck. The biggest problem I remember that happening is obscure OVA that Viz put out on VHS back in the day. I wrote a buried treasure on called Gray Digital Target.
Oh, yeah.
Where literally they spend the entire OVA building up to this big climactic final battle and the credits roll right before it starts.
Wow. Did they just not want to animate that?
I don't know what the fuck happened there.
That is kind of anticlimactic. I've never heard of that show, but...
It's old.
Yeah.
It's very old. You cannot get it. That's another one that, you know, the rest of the show isn't quite good enough to recommend it despite the ending.
Yeah, I mean, there's always exceptions to these things. Like, shonen shows like One Piece and Bleach, like, I don't care about the endings to those at all. Like, I just started One Piece, and I'm like, oh, these guys are enjoyable to watch. I mean, I'm not thinking, like, how are they going to end this, and what is the final treasure? I don't care about that. What is the One Piece? And then,
Specifically with those shows, they go way out of their way to make sure that you don't really care that much about how it ends, because they want it to run forever.
Yeah,
so, you know, journey that's written so that the journey is the important part, not the ending.
And then there's also procedural-like shows. Like, I thought of Golgo 13, which is, like, episode by episode, and it's just, yeah.
Well, that's an episodic show. There's no plot.
Yeah, which, the ending, I don't care, you know.
Right.
There's no reason to care for.
Lupin's the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't really care about the end of Lupin.
I would submit that if and when Naruto ever comes to an end, nobody would care. There is no ending you could give that show that made it worth that journey.
Yeah, you know, the same... Actually, what comes to mind is Inuyasha, where they still didn't kill the bad guy at the very end of that show. He's still not dead, and it's so... That's the only reason I went to it. I'm like, are they gonna fucking kill this guy? And they never do, and it's such a letdown, and you're like... These people must be so disappointed. As you know, another one that ended like that was Kenshin. Kenshin just piddled out. Like, it just kind of like, well, I guess it's over now. Like, it was... You stopped caring about those characters 90 episodes in or whatever, and the storytelling had gotten so rotten, you just didn't care anymore.
I wish someone at some point would just be self-aware about an ending like that and just have an epilogue where the characters just live their lives in crushing disappointment.
Well, that could have been better.
Right. It's like you see them in 20 years as a bored salary man just constantly living in the past and being like, I could have done it. I could have done it.
It's just sad sacks. Yeah.
It drinks too much, maybe, you know.
Right.
Neglectful father Naruto.
There you go. I'd pay to see that.
That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I, you know, another one that comes to mind in terms of an ending, this is obviously crippled by the fact that it was produced very early on in the manga's run, was Berserk, which a lot of people hated the ending because it literally just stops. Something horrible happens, and then it's like, to be continued with a big question mark, and then that's it. And people, I find by and large, people kind of hate those endings.
Yeah. My least favorite kind of ending is what I call the Leiji Matsumoto ending.
What's that?
Our journey is really just beginning.
Yeah.
Every Leiji Matsumoto story ends like that, and a few others rip it off, and it is the least satisfying thing because it negates everything you just went through.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. It's like, all that stuff wasn't important. The real important thing is happening next, and then it's over. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of people kind of obsess over endings a little much.
I mean, I think for good reason. I mean, if you come to the end of, you know, 7 hours of sitting in front of your TV and it's poorly, you're angry at the end, I mean, it kind of sucks. You feel like you've wasted your time, which I've definitely felt that about a lot of shows. And that's why one of the, you know, I wait and hear if the ending is solid or not, usually. Or if it's going to get licensed. Those are like the two main reasons why I don't stay most recent up to date on anime. But
I think usually the worst endings when they exist are the ones that are reserved for the spin-off movies that aren't canon. I'm thinking specifically of things like Rurouni Kenshin and even Touch. And there were a couple others. Maison Ikkoku had a redundant ending movie that was, the characters didn't act like themselves. It was just kind of didn't need to be there, and it was written by some guy who didn't just just didn't have a feel for the characters. And the whole thing just feels like a Deus Ex Machina.
I remember being really frustrated with that Maison and Koku movie because...
Oh, it's awful.
It treated, although they had, you know, they spend that entire manga, when are they going to say they love each other? That's pretty much Maison and Koku. Like, that sums up that story. They say it at the end of the manga, at the end of the TV show. And you're like, oh, well, what a nice love story. And then the movie pretends like that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so it's still building up to this thing. And then at the very end of the last shot is like, I love you. I love you, too. And you're supposed to find that what? Cathartic?
Like, it's more disturbing seeing as how they're supposed to be married the next day.
Yeah, really. Man, I remember that. That's a good one. That's a good example of a totally redundant ending. I'm trying to think of the world's the greatest, where an ending has redeemed a show. The ending is so good and it builds up to this thing that it totally redeems the rest of it.
I have a pick for that, and it's probably quite contentious to a lot of people, but
Please say Angel Cop.
No, actually I was going to say End of Evangelion, cuz as unpleasant as that TV series is, I will watch that for End of Evangelion every time, because I fucking love End of Evangelion. I think it's brilliant in almost all respects.
I can't agree with that because I really like the TV show and I love that movie, so it's a great show and a great movie, and I can't agree that it saves the show or somehow is more compelling. It's all good. In my estimation, but
if we were talking about movies, I would say Fast Five with the ending car chase makes that worth watching and recommending to everybody that I know.
I mean, that whole movie's pretty bug nuts.
That movie's completely stupid, but it's so much fun.
It is,
and that car chase scene at the end is legitimately jaw dropping. In filmmaking and how it was done. So.
The one movie I keep coming back to as an example of an indescribably shitty movie with an ending that was so good that it seemed completely out of place, Mrs. Doubtfire.
What? Explain.
Oh, come on.
Explain.
The kids spend the entire movie trying to get cross-dressing Robin Williams and the mother back together.
Uh-huh.
The ending is... literally Mrs. Doubtfire in costume narrating over a cityscape. That doesn't happen. Sometimes you have to move on, kids.
All right. Oh, and maybe I'll revisit Mrs. Doubtfire at some point. And then hang myself.
Completely unexpected.
It was a terrible, terrible movie. But that ending is just wow, that was unexpectedly harsh and realistic and will deflate kids' dreams. And I like that.
Yeah, one thing that comes to mind, I don't feel this way about this movie, but a lot of people do. An extreme example of the ending justifying the entire movie is Death Proof, which a lot of people hate that movie, but they can't deny that the ending, the last, 20 minutes of it, is fucking awesome.
Yes.
Really great, really, really great car chase at the end. And I think for most people, for a lot of people, even though I know they're going to hate the first hour of that movie, I still say, you got to see it. The car chase at the end is incredible. That is one I would say, although I don't feel that way, I love the whole movie. For most people, the ending, I think, would justify the rest of that. Maybe.
I enjoy that movie, but it so eschews the anything resembling a normal storytelling arc that I hesitate to even call it a movie.
It's more like a fun exercise.
Right.
Yeah, isn't it it's basically split up into two parts from what I remember. I mean, I haven't seen that since it was in theaters, and I think I fell asleep during it.
During the slow pans over girls' feet during a name conversation?
Yes. Yes. I remember one of those. And then I remember a car crash. And then I remember Kurt Russell getting his head bashed in.
Well, basically, it's an hour of sort of inane chatter. And then really, really kick-ass car chases that... I think the inane chatter actually endears the characters to you. I like the characters in that movie. And you kind of want to see them win. So I feel like it's justified. It absolutely makes sense. And I love that movie. But for most people, I think it's going to be this is boring. Why are we just watching these girls talk about nothing for an hour? But yeah, for most people, I think the ending justifies that movie for some people.
Has there ever been an ending that ruined a show for you? I mean, specifically anime-wise?
Yeah, besides Lost and... Yeah.
ending
that ruined the show.
I can't think of one, because, I mean, there have been bad anime endings, but usually if I enjoyed the show, I won't hold the ending against it. I'll just pretend it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little creeped out by the ending of Nadia.
I never got all the way through that. I never got through the island episodes.
Oh, yeah, well, who can blame you? I was warned about them in advance, so I knew to skip them.
I have one where it was Trinity Blood, where I don't know how I actually even made it through there, like, thinking back on it in hindsight. I mean, this must have been, like, 4 or 5 years ago, but I remember when it gets to the ending, and the ending is basically you find out the true relationship between Cain and Abel, who are, you know, the main hero and the main villain. Abel finally shows up again by the end. And then they have this retarded flashback of them being kids on, like, a space deck. Looking down from like Mars or something. I vaguely remember it, but I remember becoming so incensed. I took my Funimation box set and I threw it in the middle of the road so the snowplows could send it off to a shitty end in the Milwaukee streets. The garbage was too good for it. Oh man,
snow.
Yeah, we do. It's snowing now, so. But yeah, I was. That was when I really started thinking about, man, endings are very important to me for some reason. Because, I mean, I enjoyed that show. Like, it started pretty well, and it was kind of like a weird, like Trigun Helsing knockoff amalgamation, and I enjoyed it. And it started going downhill, but that ending was just like infuriating to me, and I've never forgiven it. and that's mostly Gonzo stuff. I think the only two that I've actually liked from Gonzo, who is plagued with bad endings and shitty second half of series, I think Genkutsuo I enjoyed, and then Romeo Juliet. But I can't really say that with, like, definitive cause, because I don't remember them that well.
Yeah. I remember enjoying the look of Genkutsuo and eventually getting quite bored with it.
Oh,
yeah.
I remember a show that the ending ruined it for me. A Wind Named Amnesia.
Oh, jeez.
I had to really go back for that one.
Yeah, no kidding.
Can you explain this one?
That's a classic.
It's you know, a post-apocalyptic Wander the Ruined World movie that I thought was really interesting and had some insightful things to say. And then it's just kind of derailed by a sex scene that just feels completely out of place and is completely unearned, and you feel a little dirty for watching it because it's literally the awesome female protagonist going to the main character. I have nothing other to pay you back with other than my body, which means she's a whore.
Oh, God.
and then just leaves everything else open-ended. It's like, okay, well, you just decided to not have an ending and have a sex scene instead. That's wonderful.
Great. You know, I just remembered a bullshit ending. It was a bullshit movie with a bullshit ending. Was Ponyo.
Oh,
I hated the ending of that movie. I mean, I was already pissed off at that movie for wasting my life, and then the ending is just like a big, hey, it really didn't mean anything. Let's not clean up any of this. The end. It's so infuriating, the ending of that movie.
God, that movie is a disaster.
I did hate that movie.
In hindsight, it's so much worse than I originally thought it was, because I saw it again, and I was like, oh man, aside from the tsunami sequence, this is a bad movie.
It really is.
Yeah, that was doubly worse for me, because after I left the movie theater, incensed with rage, I got pulled over by the cops, so... that will always live with Ponyo, as Ponyo and the police. Justin, I thought you were going to say Legend of the Dragon Kings.
Oh, right. Oh, well. Oh, God. Oh,
you
God.
You talked about it before, so I was like,
yeah, I forgot about that.
He's been scarred by that movie, that show. I'd like to hear more.
There's not much more to tell. It's literally, it pulls the, after building up to this giant climax, it was all just a dream.
I just like it whenever you are on this podcast and say, it's all just a dream. And then right. I sit here laughing at you for wasting your time.
Thank you. Hey, sorry. You know what? Just for that, I'm going to bring up my other favorite ending ever, which is a live action movie, Visitor Q.
I never saw that.
Yeah, me neither.
It's an indescribably fucked up movie. I mean, it's Takeshi Miike at such a dark, disgusting place that he had to shoot on DV. Like, he couldn't get funding to do this on film, even. But, yeah, I mean, that movie is basically the most violently dysfunctional, awful family on the planet. And, you know, there's, you know, necrophilia, there's poop, there's, you know, beatings. It's the worst family ever. The mother's a heroin junkie. By the end of it, somehow it makes you spend the whole first half of the movie just head in hands going, stop. And then the ending makes it heartwarming.
Wow.
Without changing how disgusting it is.
Oh, man. That's
interesting.
I'm morbidly curious to see this, but last time I was like morbidly curious, I watched a Serbian film and I vomited, so I think I'm going to skip your recommendation on this one.
Not going anywhere near a Serbian.
If you grew up in a Serbian film, you should probably avoid Visitor Q.
Yeah.
I will say I do admire an ending that actually doesn't cheap out, because most of the time when you have like a really brutal movie that tries to go heartwarming or tries to redeem the characters, I get kind of pissed off. I don't really, whatever. Maybe it's just like a streak of misanthropy or something, where I like it when fucked up characters are shown to be irredeemable or they don't change. One of my favorite examples of that is a movie that I really love that a lot of people don't like, called The Rules of Attraction.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah, and that ending is brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great ending. And the ending, literally, it's a movie about awful people doing terrible things to each other. And the ending is, nope, that didn't mean anything. None of that meant anything. It's literally, I think the final line is like, and I started thinking about my future, and I thought, and then it just cuts and goes to the credits.
Cuts to black.
Yeah, it's great shit. But, I mean, it's a movie full of unlikable characters doing horrible things to each other, so.
Those are the best kinds of movies.
I like those movies a lot.
I can all agree. I am in love with Antichrist, so that is about fucked up people.
Yeah, yes it
wow,
is.
Wow, that says a lot about you. Most of it not flattering.
That movie has, yeah, it's a brave movie. The ending is repulsive, yes.
The whole movie is repulsive.
But it still, I think it still says, you know, really important things about broken relationships that just can't be, fixed through sex. Horrible people having sex together doesn't make them good together, so. And it usually ends up in tears and blood sometimes, I guess.
Actually, you know, the one movie like that I've really come around on, that I thought I saw it initially, it's the kind of movie like that that I like, where it's really screwed up people doing horrible things to each other, that ends in a way that suggests this is not redeemable or they're just awful people, is Blue Valentine.
I never saw that.
I really have come around on it.
It's a great movie. I love that movie, too.
It's brutally unpleasant. Like, it's really unpleasant. But it's very compelling. Justin, I think you might actually get something out of that one. But I know you're not as big a fan of that genre.
I don't know. I really enjoyed Requiem for a Dream. And that is arguably the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, what makes those two films great is that they don't really slant your view of them. Like, you don't, like in Blue Valentine, you don't pick either one of their sides. It's not made that way.
You really can't. Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. I don't. Rec Room for a Dream is just a kind of a fun ride. I remember seeing that in theaters and walking out with my PTSD crowd going. Because they were all college boys going, oh, yeah, Jennifer Connelly's going to be nude. And then it was just like, they're like, oh,
it's
my God.
This horrifying fever dream ass to ass. Yeah.
I had a friend in college who took his mom to see that movie.
Oh, Jesus.
But that's a good kind of. I like it when the movie's really harsh and really brutal, and the ending doesn't cop out. Like the ending says, "No, we were serious about this." I like that.
Right.
That's balls. I think that's.
Yeah, great. I don't like sentimental endings at all.
I mean, I like a happy ending in a movie that has earned it and was heading there. But a movie that doesn't earn it and it wasn't heading there and then suddenly has a happy ending or tries to redeem its characters that are irredeemable, it rings false.
Yeah, that's how I felt about Super 8. And especially with that alien creature. I was like, what are you doing?
Super 8.
I couldn't get out of the theater fast enough. But I mean, that's most of Spielberg stuff I don't really enjoy, so... I guess that's just weird.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah, well, aren't you two iconoclasts? Look at how special you are.
No, it's nothing to do with being iconoclast. It has to do with, like, lowest common denominator, unchallenging. Okay, well, that's an ending.
Hey, he's made some classics, man.
Come on. War of the Worlds, when that sun shows up at the ending,
that is
I
that
literally
is
threw my popcorn on the floor in anger. I was like, what the fuck?
That's a movie where it doesn't earn the happy ending. Because it's really brutal up until the very end, when suddenly Tom Cruise is blowing up aliens with grenades and shit. But up until that point, he's running and screaming from everything, and everyone's dying around him. That's a movie that doesn't earn the happy ending, I think. He went way too brutal with it in the middle part, and then decided, oh, well, we better lighten it up and make a happy ending. And his kid runs into a firestorm with
the firewall.
magically is alive at the end. That is a bullshit ending. I'll give you that.
I also, for some reason, I wrote down in my notes, Flag, the anime Flag, also has a really great ending. I
love Flag.
Flag is, like, probably my favorite anime TV series I've ever watched. So
one of my favorite short ones, definitely.
Yeah, it's very easy to consume and quite relevant for Veterans Day now that I think of it, and reflecting on war.
I've never seen the whole thing. Is that easy to? I'm assuming it's not easy to find.
I think they did a re-release, but I'm not sure how many got made. They did one of those cheap bricks.
I don't know how many of those cheap bricks are still out there. But you can pick up. It's only 4 DVDs, and I believe on Right Stuff you can pick it up for under 80. Because they used to be like I bought them when they were like $40 for 4 episodes. And I don't know why I picked them up. I'm glad I did. But it's literally just like text and an anime girl taking a photograph. So it must have been the cover art.
Nobody bought that show.
I every time I bring it up, people are always like, I don't know what that is. It's like, yeah, no, it's sad.
Thanks for coming on and shooting the show. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
All right, up next we're talking to George. He runs the Land of Obscusion blog. You can find it at landofobscusion.blogspot.com. Hey, George, thanks for chatting with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind?
When you brought up the college show, it really just, like, right now I'm actually reaching about a year running this blog, which is really cool. And the great thing about running this blog, which just focuses on obscure and kind of forgotten anime and manga, is that looking back at the stuff I've watched and even looking at the stuff that I've watched for the blog, it actually made me realize there's a lot of really good animes, really quality titles out there that have kind of fallen to the wayside for like all sorts of reasons. And when you brought up the idea for the call-out show this week, I just thought there are like 4 titles I'd love to really just talk about and help try to give them a chance to actually be given another shot.
All right, like what?
The first one actually that I came up with was the Bartender anime from fall of 2006. You guys familiar with that one?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I lost you for a little bit. What was the title?
Bartender.
Bartender. I love Bartender.
it's a great anime, but it's never really mentioned or really heard about. Like if you mention, maybe you'll have someone hear someone say, "Oh yeah, I remember that show." But especially now with after reading a couple chapters of Volume 1 of Drops of God from Vertical, it kind of just brought Bartender back to my mind because it's just. It's such a nice, it's a kind of a slow burn. It's a show you just watch. You don't watch it for action or a big continuous story. You just watch it to like nicely calm down, listen to like a story story of a problem that someone's having.
And it's solving with alcohol.
So You know what? I think that's technically not. That's technically what a bartender has to do. That generally, that's how it is in fiction. So I think they're just going off of that. But the stories actually are really nice. They're, you know, ones you can relate to. The main character, Ryu Sasakura, is actually a very easygoing guy. You almost feel like if you saw him in real life in a bar, you'd want to tell your stories to him. And you really feel like he'd give you the proper drink, the proper cocktail to talk about it.
It's a really good show. I just love how it just contrasts the gentle, nice, relaxing atmosphere with a setup that is just so utterly ridiculous and stupid that it's almost daring you to take it seriously while at the same time relaxing you.
Well, it's been going on, I think, for more than 20 volumes now. So I think the readers in Japan are definitely buying it.
Well, any cooking-type manga does the same thing.
Oh, yeah, I guess you can consider it cooking. I mean, yeah, at the end of each episode, it does tell you how to make the cocktail that Ryu makes up. So I guess you can call it a cooking title.
Hey, bartending and making a good cocktail is just like making an amazing good dish.
I actually don't drink, but I actually find the show really entertaining. And the same thing with Drops of God. You know, I don't really drink, but I just, if it's something that tells me about something I don't know about and it does in a really good fashion, I'm into it.
Does it make you want to try it?
Maybe here and there. I'm really picky with my drink. I've only done it for super special occasions with like family and friends. It's been rare.
He thinks you need a good bartender in your life.
Probably. I won't be surprised.
I mean, it's pretty. The premise is really silly, and I personally, you know, I enjoyed the show. I didn't watch. I only watched like one or two episodes of it. And once I feel like I got it, then I got it. And I didn't really see the need to watch any more of it. Because, you know, I figured every episode was going to be cocktail of the week and someone has a problem. And they saw it's ridiculous on its face to suggest that a particular cocktail is good for a particular situation. That's not how alcohol works. It's not like, man, I owe a lot of money to the IRS. Cosmopolitan will solve this problem. Like, you know, that's not how people's relationship with alcohol is. Like, well, you're either a whiskey person or a rum person or a wine person or a vodka person. And I figured, you know, that's what people's relationship with alcohol is like. So, you know, on its face, it's a ridiculous premise. But that doesn't mean it's not enjoyable. And some of the drinks they made did seem, you know, pleasant. But yeah, that was kind of my takeaway from it. I get what you're saying, that it's sort of underappreciated. It's a very low-key show. Like, that's not the kind of thing that's going to set the world on fire. And the only, you know, I hear it mentioned in, like, the Anime World Order circles and stuff like that. Outside of that, though, yeah. No, not really. And I wouldn't pick that title to be, like, one that would get a lot of attention.
No, I'm not thinking about getting a lot of attention. It's a title that I think, you know, there are people that probably would be interested in it, but maybe they, you know, missed it the first time or they just forgot about it. I just wanted to bring to light the show again, and especially now with Drops of God coming out, there might be some other people that are like, you know, a manga that's telling you you can drink this wine and you'll feel like you're at a Queen concert. So here's one that, you know, if you have a problem, here's a cocktail that can solve it.
I mean, it does seem like kind of like maybe a Sentai type of show. I could see them picking it up, but the odds that they haven't looked at it already and passed are like zero, so... Yeah.
I was actually putting it more towards probably Nozomi, because they like to pick up these kinds of slower pace, almost the show, like something like Aria, that's like, you watch it just to feel good.
Yeah, feel better. Well, I mean, you know, and they pick up stuff when they feel like it, not when it's new, so maybe 5 years from now they'll pick it up or something.
Exactly. Who knows?
We need to browbeat Sean. I think we need to make this a project.
Mm-hmm, maybe. So what else is on your list?
The next one is... really not sure if you guys heard of this one. It's Clockwork Fighters Hero's War. It was a
You're not gonna just so you know you're not gonna okay. stump us, man. People have tried.
Do you know what column I used to write?
I'll be honest that your column partially is what inspired me to do my blog.
Oh, awesome.
Love talking about obscure stuff that, you know, it's great or quite frankly it'd be crap. I mean, I'm planning my 50th review this December, and it's going to be crap. It's going to be a horrible show, but I want to give it a proper review.
I'm looking at your blog right now, and I'm seeing a review for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles OVAs.
That is such a weird-ass OVA.
I've seen it. Yes, it is.
Yeah, I've seen it, too. So anyway, Clockwork Fighters. I've never seen it. I've heard of it. I've seen a trailer. It did not look particularly remarkable to me. But
I was totally underwhelmed by it, I must admit.
You saw the entire show?
No, I got a couple episodes in and I bailed.
I think it's one of those shows where even when you first start watching, you're like, yeah, this is definitely a kid's show. As you start watching it, though, it actually does develop a pretty neat... Well, the story's a little simple, I'll admit that, but the characters are interesting. I actually really... Since I'm a bit of a mech fan, I kind of like the idea that it took a semi-realistic take on how you could do a mech back in that era with Clockworks. It's still ridiculous. Like, they give no explanation as to how you can control a giant Clockwork mech as if it was a mobile fighter from G Gundam, but I was able to buy into it enough to enjoy it, and it actually became a pretty enjoyable show. Actually, I was kind of surprised after I did the review for Clockwork Fighters, I got a comment about someone, I think a Russian fan, who somehow, he was a gigantic fan. He went into like translating every single Japanese reference into Russian, and he found all the little mistakes Bandai did with their subtitles, which I don't doubt that. I'm sure they made plenty of mistakes on those subtitles.
I think that was the one that they outsourced entirely to Singapore.
Oh, yeah. Don't watch the... Anyone that's interested in dubs, don't watch the dub for Hero. It's probably mediocre at best.
Yeah. I don't know. It seemed like a throwaway release and didn't really catch my attention. But you're saying it's a decent kids show?
Well, the thing is that it's aimed at children, but it's actually a show that's definitely enjoyable for all audiences. Because you can say in some elements it dumbs it down, but it honestly does tackle stuff like losing family members. It deals with actual problems that you can have as a kid, and it doesn't try to like dumb it down and make it seem like, oh, everything's going to be okay necessarily. It actually tries to handle it in a somewhat realistic manner considering these kids. You have, the oldest is like a teenager and the youngest is literally a baby.
If I remember correctly, this show bombed so badly that Bandai gave up on the singles and then just pumped it out as a cheapo re-release.
Actually, they never re-released it. What they did was that they did that weird two-disc single idea, and there was like a year-long gap between the second and last volume. I think I asked about Otakon, and they just told me it was due to production issues. But yeah, actually, that show never got a re-release. Dondo got two. Clockwork Fighters gets nothing.
Wow. Now that's a buried show.
Yeah, but you know what? You actually can see a little bit, like, Bones now is generally known as a really good animation studio, and this was actually their very first work outside of doing assistance for other titles like Escaflowne the Movie. This was their first title on their own, and you can see some of that quality in there. And actually, when I went to do the review, I actually didn't think about it, but I looked at the ANN Encyclopedia, and I saw that the original creator was Noboru or Sho Aikawa, the person behind Angel Cop, and that almost blew my mind.
Oh, right. He's done a lot of wonky, kind of weird little titles like that. Like the other one that also Bandai released that never caught fire was Ayakashi Ayashi.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I saw him did that one too.
Yeah, he's very hit and miss. When he hits, he's really good. When he misses, he's interesting. I'll hear from that.
How would you consider Angel Cop?
Possibly his most interesting miss ever. But, back then he was really angry. We're talking early 90s, late 80s. He was really, really angry. And you could tell pretty much everything he made from Dog Soldier all the way through to, Orotsuki Doji.
And I think that's generally considered one of the first hentai. So that's a nice little path in his career, starting doing the first hentai and then making a kid show involving Clockwork Max.
Way not the first hentai.
Oh, okay. Well,
possibly first big tentacle hentai, but
probably
not
that. The first
hentai.
That's probably where I heard the first big tentacle porn.
Well, this is certainly worth arguing about.
But yeah,
these are important details, Zach.
Well, the nice thing about Clockwork Fires now, I guess, is because it was such a bomb, you can now actually go to Right Stuff and they're selling a bargain bundle of all three double disc singles for $24.99, which I think is less than a dollar an episode. And at that point, I would say it's worth it. If you're lucky, you can maybe go to an FYE that still exists. And if you're really lucky, find the volume one that they're selling for $1.99.
Well, so it's available if people want to check it out.
Yeah, that's the one that's really available if people want to check it out. I actually was surprised how much I enjoyed it. Every time this volume came out, I kind of almost blazed through the episodes. I honestly wouldn't thought I would have done that when it first came out.
All right, so Clockwork Fighters, and what else?
The next one is going to be... Okay, this is a long title, so bear with me. It's going to be, in Japanese, Naikaku Kenryoku Hanzai Kyosei Torishimarikan Zaizen Jotaro. Or government crime investigation agent, Zaizen Jotaro.
Jotaro, yeah.
I've heard about this, so I've never seen it.
I've seen a couple episodes.
You've seen a couple episodes, so you probably know about how absolutely horrific the first episode is.
Yes.
Yes, and that is definitely the reason why people have kind of dropped that show. I saw the first episode a little after it debuted in 2006. I was like, I'm never going to see the show again. And then about a year later, I was like, okay, was it really that bad? So I started from episode 2 and watched up to his fan sub, which I think was episode 6. And I actually really enjoyed it, what I saw, to the point where I really wanted to see how the story finished and see those last episodes. Over the years, only like one more episode got fan subbed. And then actually just about a couple months ago, you actually could find a batch that has all the raw video files and actually all subtitle files with the last four episodes taken from bootlegs, which are actually surprisingly good English. And I was able to watch the entire show. I decided to watch that first episode again. My opinion still stands that that's probably the worst first episode of all time because it gives you no actual identification and idea of what the show is about and what it's like. But the rest of the show, honestly, it does get a little ridiculous at times. That's mainly because Zaizen himself is just such a character. The artist, Yasuhiro Watanabe, actually was an assistant for Tetsuo Ohara, so it has that kind of Fist of the North Star manly look. But Zaizen himself is a really fun character to watch. Whenever he's on screen, you're always going to watch him. He always knows how to mix together serious time, when to be serious and when to be comical and have fun with his job. And a lot of like some of the ridiculous stuff comes from this card he has. It's called the Zaire's Gold Black card. And he's combined it with his GCIA badge. So he's showing it off all the time. It has his face on it. And pretty much I think a lot of people misinterpreted it as giving him unlimited funds. But when you find out what the card actually is about in like episode 6, you find out it's really just more that it gives him access to certain items that most people wouldn't be able to get access to. Like in episode 2, for whatever reasons, he decides to sneak up on a woman that he's, in a sense, got onto his side. She's on a boat. He decides to sneak up on her on a submarine. That's a ridiculous moment, but quite frankly, it doesn't really interfere with the show. Really, as the show goes on, it starts becoming more serious, and the story ends up becoming a really neat, dirty politics, dirty business kind of story with some nice little twists. Like there's one episode 6 I did not see coming when I first saw it. And even up to the last episode, I was getting ready to watch that last episode. I'm wondering, I have absolutely no idea how this show is going to end. And even up through the end of the show, I was just like, you know what? This is actually a highly underrated show. If you ever want to watch it, I just say just skip the first episode. If anything, maybe just watch it after you've seen episodes 2 through 11, the rest of the show, and then just wallow in its horribleness of that first episode.
Okay, but all these shows that you're mentioning are kind of known for being, for having like a small cluster of fans, but everyone else just kind of went, eh.
Well, actually, I don't think Zaizen Jotaro really had a big fan base because episode turned them off so much.
Okay, yeah, Zaizen Jotaro probably being the least accessible of these. Have you ever thought that just maybe you just have lower standards?
I've been told that. I mean, you said like they have little small clusters of fan base. I actually didn't even know about any sort of fan base for Hero for Clockwork Fires until I did the review. Because I first saw the show by seeing this compilation of mech anime openings, and it was a good opening. It got me interested. And when the show came out, I was like, that's certainly surprising, and barely anyone's talked about it since. That one fan I told you about was the only time I ever heard about it. So to me, that was just a show that I just watched almost since out of nowhere, and I enjoyed it. And I just felt it deserved another chance. It deserved an actual chance.
Well, I think when he says small cluster of fans, what he means is the perception that there is someone out there who really likes it, because you see like one guy mention it on a forum somewhere out of the blue.
And by cluster, I mean like four people.
Right, and that's unquantifiable. It's not like there's a site dedicated to Clockwork Fighters fandom or anything like that. I mean, you'll see it brought up. You'll see it brought out every now and then by some guy. One guy will defend it or bring it up as a forgotten treasure or something like that. But yeah, these are mostly sort of unremarkable. The only thing that's remarkable about them is how obscure and forgotten they are. Which I guess isn't like that in and of itself doesn't make them interesting. It just means that they were forgotten. Although, anyway, well, let's get to your last one before we.
The last one is I guess when Justin said low standards, this last one is definitely the one that I felt, you know, low standards, whatever. This is by far probably my most absolute favorite animes of all time because it's just so fun. It's actually the one anime I want to see licensed more than any other, even though it's probably never going to happen, but I'll still hope.
What is it?
It's Ring ni Kaketo 1.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
That has fans.
Yeah, it's been fan sub. Nobody. Yeah, boxing anime does so well here.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I kind of hesitate to fully call it a full-on box anime, and that's part of the reason probably why it had such a small fan base, because whenever you bring up boxing anime, the one title almost everyone brings up is Hajime no Ippo. And pretty much any time there's a boxing anime that's not Hajime no Ippo comes out, people have to say, oh, let me compare it to Hajime no Ippo. Let me compare it to this.
It's not a boxing anime. It's the name translates to get back in the ring.
Put it all in the ring. Well, no. It still is I say it like this. It's still a boxing anime, but I myself classify it more as just a shonen action fight manga. Because really, when you watch it, you see the boxing is really just more of a means to the end. You can tell Masami Kurumada loved boxing, but, you know, he decided to just have fun with it. Admittedly, the part of the manga that the anime skips over, which is the beginning, which actually has no real big effect on the major story, that was more like Ashita no Joe. It was more about, you know, the main character Ryuji Takane wanting to become more of an slowly learning to love boxing and mainly to defeat his rival Jun Kenzaki. Kind of like how Joe decided to actually become a boxer so he could fight Rikishi Toru. Then, after a certain point, either Shueisha or Kurumada just said, you know what, I'm just going to have some fun. Let me just put in, crazy moves and an overtop style. Let me have the world champions done in stereotypes, whether he did that on purpose or, you know, back in the 70s, that was, I guess, the thing to do. Even Kinnikuman had Brockenman, who was a good Nazi.
You know, if I had ever the urge to license a sports anime of any kind and I had the money to do it, I would probably just light my money on fire. It would be easier. It's not just, Hajime no Ippo that tanked here. Pretty much every attempt at anything vaguely sports related has utterly fallen on its face in the U.S. So, yeah.
No, I'm not going to deny that. I'm not going to deny that. But to be honest, looking at some of the reception, like generally how people act towards sports anime in general, maybe it's not the right term, but I almost have seen like this. Maybe it's not the right term again, but double standard. Whereas if it's even just a little over the top, stuff like Ring Kaketo, Prince of Tennis, Ice Shield 21, there's gonna be a lot of people that are gonna pretty much go, oh, they're not really paying homage to the sport property. They're not real fans. If they were real fans, they treat it realistically. When that's generally not the case. I'm pretty sure Takeshi Konomi is a giant fan of tennis. Masami Kurumada is obviously a big fan of boxing and MMA and those kinds of sports. But if they're handled realistically, kind of like Touch or Hajime no Ippo, which is realistic-ish, or Ashita no Joe, you get a lot of these people. You get a lot of the responses. Well, if it's that realistic, why not just watch or play the real thing? There's almost like it's either bashed because it's too over the top, or it's not even cared about because it's too realistic. There's just no middle ground where the fans could actually be like, you know what? Let me check this out. It always has to be that niche. That's how I see it. At least.
I gotta be honest. I've never heard anyone complain that the sports in sports anime are too over the top. Like, never. I've never heard anyone criticize Ice Shield 21 by saying, hey, this football isn't realistic enough. I've never heard that. With sports anime, in my experience, I'm not trying to invalidate what you're saying. I'm just saying, in my experience, I've never heard that. With sports anime, the only people I ever hear talk about it are the, like, two guys that watch it. Everyone else just seems to totally ignore its existence.
You should really check out the ANN forums a lot more. Almost any, maybe not every time, but a lot of time Prince of Tennis is brought up, there's almost... there's going to be a lot of people going, oh, it's still going around? That show's too ridiculous. And admittedly, I will admit, I think in the manga at least, it was over the top enough that at a certain point, even to me, it went, okay, you're kind of putting a little too much into this one match. And then it stays very over the top, even more over the top like that from then on. But generally, Prince of Tennis, I think, is the one that people generally love to just bash.
Well, that's because it's a fangirl favorite. That show is not about tennis. Let's not. People don't watch that show for the tennis. They watch it for the boys, right? I mean, that's what Prince of Tennis is really about.
And well, by over the top,
I read the manga, so maybe I'm going off of the sports. I haven't seen the anime, so that, at least in the anime, they talk and they animate. So yeah, I can agree with that, I guess.
Well, they also have, you know, things like, you know, someone insisting on finishing a game after a serve pretty much drills them into the concrete and breaks a femur. That's what they mean by unrealistic.
Right. I mean, that seems like just like fan whining. Like, I would never read.
I've
I would
seen
never.
A lot of it.
I guess so. I mean, telling me to read my own forums more is.
No, I'm not telling you. I'm just saying it has come up, and I've had to bring up, you know, why you hating. I had to bring up to some of these people on the internet forums, why are you, you know, okay, I can understand you're not liking it, but to just, you know. It's almost like they're trying to put it down to the absolute extent just because it could be over the top. And it does happen. And I've looked all around, you know, other places on the internet, and there's a lot of that going on.
Well, Prince of Tennis is with male fans especially, you know, the kind of male fanboy that loves to hate on things. Prince of Tennis is kind of a holy grail of shit they hate on. A show that is unabashedly for women and sports. So you have two things they love to hate in one package. So yeah, they're gonna shit on Prince of Tennis.
No, like I said, the Prince of Tennis gets shit on the most.
Right.
But again, Ringa Kendo to me, sorry, to me, it has good action. But to me, I think the part I love the most about Ringa Kendo 1 is just it's pure concentrated fun. I can almost like turn on an episode and I'll know I'll be enjoying myself. That's how the show is for me. And I think even a few years back, I saw Andrew Cunningham, professional translator. He's called the show the giant robo of boxing anime, and I can't argue that. I think it's probably a very good descriptor of the show.
No, that's not a TV show. That's like an OVA, right?
The giant robo, yeah.
No, not giant robo. Ring the Kaketo.
Ring the Kaketo is it's still going on, actually, to it somewhat. There was a 12-episode season in fall of 2004, another 12-episode season in spring of 06, and then this spring and then last spring, there were two 6-episode seasons.
Oh, okay. So those were OVAs.
Well, they were on... Well, it's weird. The third season was on Animax's pay-per-view channel, while the fourth season was on Animax. And, well, X-Men was on Animax, so I guess you could say the fourth season was, in a sense, a TV series.
Okay.
But the thing is that I'll be honest... I guess I'm just hardcore enough of a fan. I actually had to buy the DVDs for season 3 just to watch the show at all because there weren't even any Raws ripped of it. And
wow, yeah.
Oh my god, after buying those DVDs, I don't want to buy another Region 2 DVD ever again. I mean, it's great quality, but the price.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Oh yes.
Yeah, that is destined.
I was happy to see Raws. They're not the greatest Raws, but Raws come out for season 4. I was like, thank God I don't have to spend $200 plus.
Right. No, I'm sure.
But I would gladly pay the price if I ever got licensed. Again, the chances of it happening are next to non-existent. If it was to happen, though, you know I'd be cheering it and I'd be pre-ordering it right away.
And so. You'd be their one customer.
Well, you know what? That's a funny thing. The thing about Ring the Kaketo that I noticed is, I'm not going to try to say it's all me or anything, but ever since I did the reviews for the first three seasons and the 5-minute pilot film that was made before those seasons back in December last year, since then there has been of course, compared to other animes, it's minuscule, but there has been an increase. I've been checking on the encyclopedia of its ratings, not just in the number of ratings it's been given, but the overall score, like that curve you can give it for like how its ratings are. And like season 1 has now gone very much on the very like on the very good scale. Before it was kind of mixed on very good and very bad. Season 2 about the same thing, and actually seasons 3 and 4 are both on the top 10 most underrated anime list over at anime that the encyclopedia compiles. With season 4 actually, to me, I find this a little amusing. Season 4 is actually, in a sense, like with a very close battle with Hoshio Kodomo, that new Makoto Shinkai movie, for most underrated anime, according to the Anime Encyclopedia at ANN. And it's literally like a hundredth, like hundredths of a decimal point away from, you know, difference with like one vote. To me, I just found that hilarious. And it felt kind of nice to see that almost after those reviews came out. Again, it's probably coincidental, but there is slowly starting to be a bit more appreciation for the show.
Yeah, I find that funny, especially since calling any Makoto Shinkai anything underrated is not accurate.
Oh no, yeah. Even when I first saw it, I went, Yeah, it's on there. It's not going to last. The moment it gets licensed, it's going to go away from being underrated.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, so you recommend it for fans you seem reticent to call it, or reluctant to call it a boxing anime, but that's what it is.
It is a boxing anime. It does involve boxing, but to me, I would first call it a shonen action fight title, kind of like the tough stuff in Shonen Jump. The stuff like Fist of the North Star, Saint Seiya, Dragon Ball, One Piece. You know, this came out back in 1977. It's generally considered Shonen Jump's first, like, mega hit. It was the first title to really be a gigantic hit for the company. And a lot of the stuff you see nowadays, there was at least a prototype of that idea, that cliche, that trope in Ring Nikaketo. So I think to the fact that even almost next year is the 35th anniversary of its debut, almost 35 years later, it still holds up pretty well. Maybe it's a little generic, but it still holds up very well. Actually, it's really cool.
All right, cool. Well, I mean, appreciate the recommendations, and good luck with your blog. And thanks for letting us know about these shows.
No problem. Thanks for having me, man. I love the that's my thing. I love to talk about these kinds of shows.
All right. Well, so anyway.
I love the more recent stuff. I love the popular stuff too. But to me, I love digging through that stuff and finding the gems, kind of like Justin did.
Right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, take
Godspeed, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Joining me back again for a second appearance on the show, it's a moderator of Evangelion panels out on the East Coast. It's V Guy. How's it going, V Guy?
Ahoy!
Thanks for coming back. So you had a sort of a pet issue. I'm gonna go ahead and guess it has something to do with Evangelion. But what's your premise, man?
Well, it's just, and this isn't really that current, but I stumbled onto this that an anime reviewer by the name of Madeline Ashby. This is that whole Tolkien versus Evangelion thing where. It's something where on Twitter she said, while you were reading Tolkien, I was watching Evangelion. And this happened in 2009. And mm-hmm. a friend of hers turned it into a button they were handing out at conventions and panels and whatnot, saying, while you were reading Tolkien, I was watching Evangelion. And this encapsulates, well, there's a divide in fandom between sci-fi fans and fantasy fans and anime fans. And I noticed that earlier this year she ran a panel at an academic convention titled, while you were reading Tolkien, I was watching Evangelion, and I'm more confused than anything because this isn't my fan site, my group of people versus another group or anything. It's just I've never seen any group of Ava fans really against fantasy. I mean, like, pretty much everyone I know, friends or not friends, who like Ava like Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and now Game of Thrones. So I just wonder, where is this division coming from? I've never seen any of that.
I mean, I don't even know what that's... I guess I'm on your side here, because I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Like...
Yeah.
What, like, while you were, you know, is Lord of the Rings supposed to be, like, lesser, or... Because, I mean, those are both things that nerds like.
I guess it's because it's the thought-provoking amount of it, but, like, on my shelf, I have Lord of the Rings and Philosophy from that series, but... There have been lots of academic articles on Tolkien and the thought he put into his cosmology and for years, and not just like reading into it. He had a lot of theological ideas he worked into the thing with his religious views. But still, I think you say if people can interpret things, they should, that this is interesting that they have these views. Well, you can interpret Tolkien and come up with interesting interpretations just as much as Ava, so... I don't think either one is more thought. I mean, they are in different ways, but I don't really see this division between fantasy and anime fans. And I just want to come on to say, I don't think that's a thing. And I don't really think one or two voices can turn that into a catchphrase. That it's strange.
That's really, that's really strange. And looking at this online, you know, looking at what this actually was, I guess she was trying to make a point about science fiction being superior to fantasy, which...
In her blog, she didn't even finish reading The Lord of the Rings, and it's a long story, and like the first third is exposition, but it gets going after a while, and you can't just skip to the flashy parts. I mean, part of it's world building.
It seems like, I mean, I hate to just dismiss this out of hand, but this seems like an attention-seeking thing more than a legitimate argument. I mean, do fantasy fans and sci-fi fans actually sort of go after each other? Do they resent each other? Because I've certainly never seen that.
I mean, even with, you know, all the internal divisions between anime fans or even Ava fans, everyone I've heard of has never had a beef with fantasy. I mean, you're on a real obsession with Game of Thrones nowadays.
Hey, I wouldn't call it an obsession. I'm into it.
Oh, who's your house? I'm House Targaryen all the way. Danny's going to get her revenge and slaughter all those honorless Starks and Lannisters.
Okay. Well,
the point, yeah, it's like, I just went to New York Anime Fest last month, right? And that kind of encapsulates, you know, it's a convention with sci-fi fantasy panels and anime panels. And, like, I went out of a Dragon Age panel to an anime industry panel to then a sci-fi panel. And the floor is mixed, but everyone seems to be getting along.
I think this is one of those things where it's somebody trying to gin up sort of a false division in order to have something to talk about, which is actually fairly common. Like, I've seen it before where someone's like, oh, you wouldn't believe the division between Harry Potter fans and Lord of the Rings fans. Boy, they just hate each other. It's like, no, they don't. Like, that doesn't...
Well, actually, there was... That's because the movies came out right the same month. That was just bad timing. I mean, with time, that's really gone away. I mean, I used to really be Lord of the Rings versus Harry Potter. It just, that was two big series coming out at the same time, head-to-head. Of course.
I know, but that was, what, like 2 months of contentiousness, and then no one cared, and everybody went into their little geek corner and liked what they liked?
Yeah,
and
3 to 4 years into it. Like 2004, we weren't really at each other's throats anymore.
Well, Lord of the Rings was over for a year at that point. That franchise dropped off the face of the earth when that last movie came out.
Well, it's just with all that, and people need to imagine these divisions. And, like, by the way, I had fun at New York Anime Fest. Some people are saying, oh, they moved everything together. I went last year, too, and last year they had some problems with, you know, merging these two conventions with floor space and stuff. This year there was no crowding at the anime booths like Funimation Section 23 on the dealers floor. They planned out the seating better. That was fine. The artist's alley was now in this, they had this gallery thing on the fourth floor. There was a ton of space for that. The one thing is, I wish there were more fan panels, and that's, they got to figure out how to balance that. I mean, but that isn't just an anime problem. I mean, something I saw in all sorts of reviews, like the Colony Drop review for this, was the lines were long for everything. I mean, the Dragon Age panel, I had to come an hour and a half early to be online for that. But that isn't an anime problem. They're not sidelining that. They have to balance that they have this big convention now.
Well, so we can tie these two things together so that this is...
No, I'm just saying, I didn't see any division between anime and fantasy fans there. And
no, I don't think those exist. I think within anime fandom, you have a divide of people who are really into moe and otaku culture and people who, you know, maybe don't like that stuff and like the older stuff and like the stuff that's, you know, the Ghost in the Shells and the Akiras and reject the, you know, whatever... Kaons of the world. That is a real division. It does exist, and it's because those are two wildly different tastes.
Don't think Hitalia is any less anime than Ava is, and I like them both.
You're right. Okay, well, you know, that's fine, but those divisions exist within fandoms. Those do exist. And it's only on the internet. Like, you're not going to see people ripping each other apart in person or anything. Suggest that, like,
online say, I hate that dub fan. They're not a real person. Who invents these divisions?
You know, people snipe at each other online all the time, but to suggest that there's like, oh, fans of fantasy, like traditional British or American fantasy, like Dungeons and Dragons, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter or whatever, don't like anime or have some weird, that doesn't exist. Yeah. I don't, that came out of nowhere. I think she came up with this slogan and thought it was controversial attention getting.
I just wanted to come on your show briefly, just say, I heard this, like, I already heard of it, like, 2 years ago, and then I saw recently, wow, she titled her panel this, and it's, if you repeat it often enough, it doesn't become a catchphrase, it doesn't work that way, and so few people, I've never even encountered a single person who was so, I like anime, I hate fantasy, but...
It's weird, and look, I don't know this lady, I'm sure she's a fine person.
I wish I had seen her panel. Yeah.
Right. See, neither of us really know the content here, so I'm not sure what it is she's trying to say. You can infer from that.
Let me be clear. I wish I had been able to see more of her panel and stuff, and I tried reading this stuff on her website, and it was part of her thesis, and it seemed like great, insightful work. It was this great article she wrote on Ghost in the Shell and Lane and Ava, and it's stuff about the Cyborg Manifesto and stuff. And this all made sense, but it's you really shouldn't be slinging around this "we hate fantasy fans" thing.
Well, if it's couched like
it could be nothing
philosophically, like large in a larger sense. You're not going to get anywhere making that your hook anyway to get people interested in things. I've seen this a lot, actually, where somebody needs a hook for their academic paper because they want to make it seem hip or groundbreaking or whatever. And so they'll contrast it with something that it really has nothing to do with in order to make it seem more interesting. She could have just written about this stuff in apparently the insightful way that she did without saying, "And look at this crap over here." Like, that's an unnecessary component. But I do see that. I have seen that a lot. Where it's like, look at this amazing genre. It's so much better than whatever. And more, you know, most commonly I see that when people talk about really great television in contrast to garbage TV. Like, you don't need to mention the garbage TV or attack it as though these are two opposing forces. It's a weird kind of a little bit of a bankrupt argument. It's not a good attention getter. It's not a good hook.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm really not trying to start a thing here. I hope she really doesn't dislike Tolkien that much. I hope I'm just making too much. I'm just saying it's a bad tagline. It's probably a great panel. I wish I could have seen it and it was online or something. But
well, you specifically, you have a real thing with division among fans. Like, you seem to be have a little bit of an obsession with inclusion.
Look, we're all fans, and just to, it's that whole, I'm wondering if this is an echo of that thing from, I've seen this from like 90s fandom, that we watch anime and it makes us special and it would make it less special if more people knew about it. Whereas my thing is, I want to be able to like, "Hey, did you see Game of Thrones last week? Yeah, it was great." I want to be able to have more people know about anime so we can include more people in it. It's not just some secret thing. It's like part of the secret club.
Right, which goes back to your chief argument about Evangelion being, you know, a very inclusive or accessible show, not this complicated beast that people make it out to be.
Generally, yeah, that if you actually sit through and watch a whole thing. But the weird part about this whole thing that it ties into is Ashby's papers are about transmedia things, and I don't know it that as well as some, but the whole transmedia idea, you know, like the Animatrix and others, and the Matrix comics, that these were canonical, and part of the story was that it expands with the audience. Like, Harry Potter would be even better. That, like, there's so much fan fiction, which is people regard as semi-canon and famous in its own right, that the greater Harry Potter experience is this whole shared, it's in different media formats things. So, my point is, in her article, she says Ava has expanded to be movies and TV shows and remake movies and video games, and look at how many platforms it's spread to. Well, in a way, I think that's a backhanded way of de-stressing End of Ava. And that we have this whole controversy that, well, there's a finale movie and it came out in America 5 years after the series, but lots of things have finale movies. Serenity, Gundam, specifically Space Runaway Idian was the model they were trying to copy. Well, once they realized, oh geez, we should make a finale movie, we ran out of money. There have been finale movies before, Char's Counterattack, whatever. So by saying, look at all of these spin-offs, and by the way, there's this movie called End of Ava, no, that should be in the box set with Ava, and I hope someone license rescues it sooner or later. But you see what I mean, that by saying, oh, it's all transmedia, it's de-stressing how important the End of Ava was. And even in one of our articles, she says, well, I was watching with a sci-fi author, and he said, this doesn't really have a lot of payoff. Well, they have a movie aptly called The End of This Show. just the weirdness that she wants to categorize, we are anime fans, you are fantasy fans, and by the way, all of the Ava spinoffs are on equal standing, which seems that she doesn't want to categorize the media. You see what I mean? That just strikes me as so weird. That wouldn't we want to see, again, your position is that, well, it's a different interpretation and that's their point of view. And I've been a little too hard on the Ava spinoff manga now, and then I've just grown to really kind of enjoy Sadamoto's manga version of it by Viz. That's a great manga, but that's a different continuity. And it's kind of not the same as this is a finale movie meant to go with the show. We should have categories that say this is like I don't know, the Gundam X universe versus the Gundam Universal Century continuity to at least know which ones to watch with what other ones. We need some categories.
Well, now that we're on topic number 15. I don't think you can argue, like, I'm with you in that I think, like, End of Evangelion should absolutely be considered part of the series, like, must watch when you're done with the show. You need to see the movie if you want the full experience. And suggesting that it's not that important and the TV show is singular and you don't need to watch that movie, I don't agree with that at all. I would say, like, if you watch the show, you should immediately put the movie in afterward, and then we can talk. But if you haven't seen that movie, we can't talk about Evangelion, you know?
It kind of changes how you perceive it, but I think this is kind of a relic of stuff that Sherrilyn Orbau and Susan Napier wrote about. It's most of the academic articles written on Eva were written in the immediate aftermath of, what, 3 to 4 years? And End of Eva came out in North America so late that most of these opinions solidified before the real finale came out over here. And like in her famous article on Eva, Napier spends literally one sentence waving it away, going, literally, End of Eva was revenge on fans. And well, it's a bit more complicated than, oh, they were just doing that to get back at us. And this is a whole debate in Eva fandom. I don't, you know, I'm not going to settle it right now right here about, well, which ending was the right one, but you should at least watch them together to be able to debate that instead of saying, oh, End of Eve is just a relic that we should forget about over time. I really think you need to watch it with everything else just as much as you need to watch, I don't know, Char's Counterattack to get the whole Gundam story.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't consider arguing for even a minute that it's not very important to that whole show. I mean, I love that movie, and I think it's, I mean, I like both the TV ending and the movie, but I think the movie's much better. And you should watch it. Like, if you're a fan of the show, if you like the show, definitely watch that movie. And I don't understand why anyone would argue against that or that it's not significant. That doesn't make any sense.
While I'm on here, one caveat I'd make that I send it in Twitter questions and stuff is, like, if Death and Rebirth – I think you might be able to skip Death and Rebirth because that was meant as, like, a clip show episode at five. And if it's going to cost $2 million to get both movies as a package deal and no one's ever going to pay that much – maybe we should just have someone license rescue End of Eva.
Well, no, at this point, you know, I've tried to get the answer about what is the licensing price for End of Evangelion right now.
What's this whole thing, yeah.
I've tried to get that. I tried to get that number. The $2 million thing has been...
I made up a number.
No, that actually is... That was the number back when before it got licensed. That was the number. They wanted $2 million for it. That's an old story. It's not worth that now, but that was the number back then. Now it's a bit of a relic. It's important to watch if you want to see the TV show, but I hope someone can rescue license rescue it at some point. It can't possibly if they're still asking for millions of dollars for it, then they're insane because it's certainly not worth it.
Fidex needs that money because they can't hold on to it if you sewed it into their pants. They're not good with money, but the one that, you know. We have complaints about, the End of Eve English dub and stuff. Like, other than, like, fixing up one or two translation errors, which, like, every anime has a translation error here or there that you want the remaster to fix, or, like, oh, there was a sound gap in that one scene, or fix up the video quality, I love that dub. I think they did a good job. I just want to remaster it, you know? I'm not on here saying, oh, we need to get someone to do it right. It was done right originally. It just needs a good release. You know, with a audio-visual cleanup, that's all.
And I
want to package the series so people will know this is kind of one unit.
Yeah, I don't like Evangelion dubbed, period. Like, I watch it subtitled. That's just a personal preference. I prefer the Japanese performances.
I can respect it. Is closer to what, you know, the author wanted to do. Well, for me, it's I get twice as much show that way, and it's not like an expansive universe. There's only so much.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I would love to see that movie come back out again. And I do want a Blu-ray. I really want a Blu-ray. And I'm sure they are planning a big Evangelion TV show Blu-ray release. I'm sure they are. There's no way they're not.
One of the things you can't even tell, like, unless you really zoom in on, like, the Japanese version, and it's blurry anyway, is, like, when, like, the mass production Avas or the whole fight scene, they're stepping on people. Like, they're stepping on tanks, and you see people running around getting stepped on. You can see this in a theater. But you can't see it on the DVD really well. But they're stomping on people. And I think you could see that on a Blu-ray. Just how much destruction they're causing. They thought that out.
No, I mean, the show was shot on film, so it's going to look great on Blu-ray. The film, obviously, was shot on film, so it's going to look great. Like, that's going to be a really great release. I know they're holding on to it because it's going to be a giant moneymaker, so they're probably sitting on it for a while. But we're going to, I am sure we're going to get some absolutely insane Ava TV.
Yeah, I wonder, how popular that would still be, because it is a popular series. This is one of those series that's just always going to be popular, like Cowboy Bebop, everything. Not hugely popular, but, you know, background level, this is a classic. And if someone releases that, it's going to be like printing money.
Yeah.
And if they bundle it with the series, people pay like $200 for a whole box set, and it'll be worth it.
If they do like an Evangelion Blu-ray box in Japan, it's not going to be $200. It's gonna be a lot more than that. You're talking crazy money at that point. But we'll see what happens. There's still a lot of life left in that franchise, and we're all looking forward to the next movie. So
yeah, whenever everything comes out. But I like the job Funimation has been doing on Rebuild. You know, the Rebuild 2 release was pretty good. I like they got more extras in it. I devoted more time to that. I mean, well, it's going to be a long wait for the Ava fan sites, waiting a whole year. But, you know, I see it as, well, glass half full. We have time to prepare all of our little fan guides to make sure everyone's better informed about, all right, this is what they're doing in here.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, so I think to sort of put a button on this,
I don't think we should categorize fans as fantasy fans versus Ava fans. The only enemies are the Rei Shinji shows, distinct from Rei Ayanami fans. I'm talking about people making Rei Shinji romantic fan art. Those people should die like pigs in an abattoir. Rei Shinji? You're crazy. Asuka's the main female character anyway. No, but everyone else, we're all fans. We shouldn't be inventing these divisions.
All right, man. Well, it was good talking to you. All right, man. Well, so people can your site is revolutionofeva.org.
revolutionofevangelion.org.
Okay. Well, that's where people can and it'll be back. You guys are planning some stuff.
We just put up some new interviews we got with Rena Palencia, John Swayze, and some of the other Rebuild cast members. Check it out.
All right, man. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
And finally, our final call-in guest is X, otherwise known as X, I guess. Thanks for coming on. What's on your mind, man?
Well, I want to talk about the whole situation with the how the Gundam Age subtitles was handled, and how and the kind of impression it generates for a fan when you see a company kind of fumble a bit with how they release information.
Okay, so what exactly was the story with Gundam Age? Justin, do you recall?
No, I don't.
Okay, back in the October, like October 6th or 7th, maybe 8th, there was a press release put up on ANN stating that there's going to be Gundam Age subtitles put up on the Gundam Info YouTube channel, and basically that was it. But the next day, when Age actually aired for us US viewers, everyone found out that it was region locked to Southeast Asia only, and this was never mentioned in the original press release, which kind of ticked off a whole lot of people, as you can rightfully understand.
Mm-hmm.
So and as a fan, from my perspective, I mean, it doesn't make any real business sense, because you've got pretty much a perfect service set up. You've got Gundam material streaming on YouTube, which is easily accessible through all sorts of platforms, mobile, PC, and even game consoles if you got like the right media server program. So doing this kind of thing, it seems like a bit of false advertisement, and just really pushes more people into streaming fan subs, and really dropping down Sunrise's perception. Which, if you're just talking about normal anime fans, they're all right. But if you're talking about Gundam fans, it depends. It's really sketchy.
Well, okay. I mean, the truth is, you don't know. And none of us know
what exactly happened here. Obviously, they announced something that wasn't entirely, didn't entirely pan out, did not happen for whatever reason. I would be indescribably shocked if that was intentional. I do not know of a company that would do that on purpose because it's just bad business. So that being the case, there was probably some mitigating circumstance behind the scenes. As a content owner, honestly, YouTube is the last resort. They don't pay that well. Their tools to target towards a specific group are not not all that refined. And honestly, the discovery is kind of weak. The problem with uploading professional content on YouTube is that it kind of gets lost among the sea of birds singing the Evangelion theme song and things like that. So it's not ideal. I would bet that there was probably some miscommunication at Sunrise. One hand wasn't talking to the other. That happens all the time at larger companies and even smaller companies like ours. So I don't think there's anything to be gained by, you know, feeling wronged by this. Obviously, someone screwed up, but I don't think ascribing malicious intent or outright stupidity is, you know, is going to get you any answers. I think what we're probably seeing is just someone had plans for the North American market, didn't tell them, didn't tell the right people, plans didn't work out fast enough. We don't know what's going to happen next. That's my guess.
Yeah, I mean, from a business perspective, I can totally understand that they probably have plans for the licensing and eventually dubbing it, because that's what they usually do these days with the new Gundam shows. But basically, I mean, I would have been okay if they just said, hey, we messed up, you know, we're still working on licensing. And in their second press release, I'm not sure if that was actually a press release, the one that came out the day the aid subs came out, or if that was just ANN reporting that. But, I mean, it would have been nice to see that they admitted to like, a screw-up.
Companies don't do that. No company does that.
Well, that's true. That's true. But basically, for like, Gundam fans, it's just like a little bit more evidence to for confirmation bias that they kind of don't really care about about us, honestly. Because, I mean, while they do put out like all sorts of Gundam content that, honestly, I'm surprised that they actually go to the effort of putting it out, because, frankly, Zeta, F91, and like Turn A, they really aren't going to get like too much money out of that, because there's no like TV distribution. And I mean, they kind of got screwed over when they licensed the 00 dub with Sci-Fi, because basically Sci-Fi just mishandled that entire block. But essentially, we Gundam fans kind of get screwed over with like everything else besides the shows. So it doesn't really bode well, because we're kind of optimistic a bit, because they actually put out a video, a behind the scenes video with the director, the writer, and one of the producers, and they really haven't done that kind of thing in my memory, and that sort of brought up our opinion of Sunrise and their level of commitment to like revitalizing the brand in America.
Well, revitalizing the brand is all well and good, but it's not going to be done via the hardest of hardcore fans. If revitalizing the brand means reaching the masses.
Oh, yeah, I mean, obviously, but...
And YouTube is not going to do it. The subtitled simulcasting anywhere really isn't going to do that.
Of course, I mean... The goal is obviously to get onto if not a cable network with that is on most cable packages or satellite packages in America, at least some form of a televised broadcast. But I mean, it's just nice to see that for once, there's actually a hope that we might actually get more of the stuff that they make just beyond the shows, you know, like some of the games. Because honestly, Age is probably the best bet, like, for really
getting... Yeah, it's mainstreamable, it's kid-friendly, it's totally... It would stand a chance. And I would bet money that Sunrise knows that, and that's exactly why it's not on YouTube. If I'm selling a TV series, a brand new TV series to, say, Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network or any of the outlets that might carry it, the first thing they're going to ask me is this premier content? Has this been seen anywhere before? The minute I say, well, it was legally simulcast on YouTube, I will probably get a thank you for your time and be shown the door.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I understand that. Just that they could have just said so, you know, after the whole thing kind of went down. But I mean, I understand how the business works. It's just that...
Well, if I could interrupt here for a minute, I think you say you understand how the business works, but you're not applying it to your feelings as a fan. And if you understand how the business works, I don't understand why you would feel slighted or wronged by anything that's happened.
I don't necessarily feel slighted. I just feel that, you know, that actually I really didn't care that much because I was kind of bummed because I was actually looking forward to, you know, seeing it legally in a way that, you know, the content providers would, you know, get some ratings and you know, and see that some people actually do want to see it legally instead of just going straight to the fan subs. And plus, I was kind of looking forward to being able to sit down at my couch and just watch it on my Xbox. But
it was disappointing, and I'm sure that was disappointing for Bandai as well. I'm sure, you know, when they made that announcement, they wanted you to be able to watch it on your Xbox. They wanted you to be able to legally stream it. And, you know, these things happen. I mean, rights in this situation, they're complicated. Every show is different. There's no way to predict exactly what's going to happen with every single show. And I totally understand your disappointment and that's completely, understandable. But, you know, understanding the business side of it is very important. And, you know, I don't know. I guess if you do understand the business side, I don't understand why that would then translate into, well, I guess I'm upset because they didn't do this.
Well, it's not so much the fact that they kind of, you know, dropped the ball on the streaming. It's that if they're really going to, you know, relaunch the whole Gundam brand in America. I mean, it would be nice to see, like, a bit more openness. Because, honestly, that behind-the-scenes video was pretty nice, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, because it actually made us feel like they cared, you know, that we could get to see a little bit of the behind-the-scenes, get, like, a bit more insight into what the creative people were thinking.
Well, but no relationship with the Japanese producer is ever going to be like Funimation, where you have like a Lance, you know, answering every question and like, you know, saying, well, this didn't work out and being very transparent. That's just not how that's an anomaly in any entertainment field, let alone a Japanese company.
Yeah, obviously. But, you know, it'd be nice to hear like a little bit more because basically all we're going on is, like, rumors from 2chan, which is not really the best source of information, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, look, American Gundam fans are marginalized because you're not a profit center for Sunrise. The show's never been a big success here. It's never hit like it did in Japan. It doesn't sell toys like it does in Japan. It doesn't sell models like it does in Japan. It's just not the phenomenon here that it is there. And so what I understand what you're saying. You're basically saying, like, I wish they would marginalize us less and maybe give us throw us a bone a little more often. But yeah. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us, man. Take care.
You too.
Okay, that's our show. Thanks to everyone for coming on. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And hey, while you're there, leave us a rating, a little review. We'd appreciate it. The Goof Troop thing was Justin's fault. He's the one who brought it up, so don't blame me. And hey, see you all next week.